Good morning. It's Thursday, April 5th, and this is Eric Hufschmidt, and I'm talking with Christopher Bolin today. Christopher.
Yes, Eric. Hello. Can you hear me all right?
Yes. So, Christopher, it's been a while since we've talked to you. So how about, first of all, giving us an update on what has been going on with your court case?
Yes. I've been to court a couple of times, perhaps, since I spoke to you last. And my court date has now been determined to be April 23rd. That's a Monday, about 2.5 weeks from now. And it's going to be a jury trial. I've requested a jury trial. I have a new lawyer. I'm trying to raise money. I have to raise a couple thousand dollars more to pay for this attorney. And he wants to be paid before we go to trial. And so if people do want to donate to my legal defense fund, they can go to iamthewitness.com to Chris Bolin, and they can make a donation there. That'll help. I've also hired a couple of private investigators to investigate the conduct of the police, of these three men who were not identified as police, but who came to my house and assaulted and tasered me last April 15th. They also fractured my right elbow. And what I'm dealing with now is, if people are familiar with the Chicago police, they're pretty brutal, and they have a tendency to lie. And what's most troubling is that they're allowed to perjure themselves in the stand. And right now, I have subpoenaed evidence with my lawyer, and the evidence that I have gotten, what they've returned to us from the subpoenas, is woefully inadequate. And they're trying to play games. But that's what I'm up against.
Well, what is this, when you say they may not, the three of them may not be police officers, what else could they have been?
Well, they were dressed in civilian dress. They were wearing blue jeans and t-shirts, and they had these dark blue armored vests on, and then they had all kinds of guns and taser apparatus on their holsters. And they came to my house, and what's most interesting is that I had called 911, because I was concerned because I had seen this car going around my house for 2 days in a row. And when I called 911, which is the number you call to call the police in this part of Buffalo State, Illinois, the 911 operator sent a uniformed police to my house. But what's very interesting is that this gang of three called in, they communicated to 911 and said, "We'll go instead. Let us go. And don't send Officer Fitzgerald, but we'll go and take care of it." And they were able to take over this call. Now, this is very important because I had called because I was very concerned about this gang of three armed men around my house. And rather than having a normal uniformed officer come to my house to explain what these people were doing, these three thugs were allowed to come to my house of their own volition. And then they came to my house and they refused to identify themselves or explain their business or say that they were responding to the 911 call. Well, you can imagine what kind of consternation and fear that my wife and I felt. They wouldn't tell us who they were. They wouldn't leave. They wouldn't say what they were doing. They had only 20 seconds of communication with me. Then one of them unsnapped his holster. And when he unsnapped his holster, I said, I have to get my brother, I need some help. And I turned to the house, I went about five steps, and they tackled me and tasered me.
Well, if these people, if they had somehow taken over, you know, I mean, when you know, you said when you called 911, they contacted the police and said they'll go first. How did
they told 911 dispatch that they would handle the call? You see, 911 dispatch did the proper thing. They assigned a black and white, a normal police car with a normal uniformed officer, which is what I had agreed, what I had said, what I expected to come to my house, which is what anybody expects to come to their house when they call for, a non-emergency call. There's something they're concerned about, then usually you send a uniformed officer in a car. This is just normal police protocol. But in this case, what happened was that these three men who were not identified chose to come to my house and told 911 dispatch that that's what they were going to do.
Well, how do you know they told the 911 dispatch this?
Because we have from my Freedom of Information Act request, I've gotten information, you know, transmission logs from the 911, and we were able to discern a great deal. But then from the subpoenaed evidence, we now have some more information, like transcripts of the 9/11 from the 9/11 dispatch. So we're able to put it together like that. And now I realize that you know, the chief of police told us that he had sent this group to my house, although it was about 8 o'clock at night. But this is what happened. They chose to come to my house. Now the question is, who were they working for? Because this tactical unit, you can call them undercover or plain clothes, is very unusual. And it's even most unusual if they're going around my house for 2 days in a row, in very close surveillance of my house.
But the chief of police said he sent them?
Yes, on the 17th of August, when we had a sit-down tape recording interview with him and the village manager, that's what he told us on tape, that he had sent them. And what's interesting is that the longer this goes on and the more information we find, the more we find that the police are lying about every aspect of this.
Well, what about the...
Are they lying just to protect themselves from a civil suit, or are they lying to protect somebody else?
Well, what about the dashboard cameras on the police cars?
Good question. This John Fitzgerald, the officer who was first sent to the scene, he pulled up. These three men have parked in front of my house. They're standing on the driveway. They're talking to my wife, myself, my 8-year-old daughter. We're trying to find out who they are, trying to find out what they want. And just about the time that this officer is unsnapping his holster, my wife sees from the corner of her eye that a car pulls up right behind this car. She didn't register that was a police car because it was behind the tree a little bit, but it was. It was Officer John Fitzgerald. And he pulled up on the scene, and police procedure indicates that he would then activate his camera, his video camera. And he was about 20 feet from the incident, happened right next to him, actually, when the police tackled me, held me down, knelt on my head, and tasered me. He saw all that. He videotaped it. But when we were in court the other day, the village attorney said that tape has been destroyed. That videotape has been recycled, was the word. It was a digital recording device. And it's interesting because this is, again, a violation of the procedures. Their procedures say that when they have videotape of an arrest, which is necessary for the prosecution, it is considered as evidence and has to be preserved. But obviously they chose to destroy this tape or recycle this tape or withhold it because the evidence that it shows would show what they did to me and would, of course, play in my benefit, would show that I've been tackled and treated very badly by the police. You know, like any of these police videos. There's a police video of a Chicago police beating up a small Polish bartender, a woman, a couple weeks ago, and now there's some more tapes. So the Chicago police have a big history of this kind of thing. And this is just another incident. But in this case, I'm not just an innocent bartender who didn't serve the cop a drink. I'm a 9/11 researcher who's come up with a lot of, you know, very, I think, pretty solid evidence of who did 9/11. And so there's another dimension to what happened to me than there is to the, for example, the bartender.
Well, do you have any idea yet who those three are working for or any?
Yeah. Well, I think that you were right. When you came out, when you heard about this and you put the blame on ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, I think you're that's correct. But I think there's other agencies involved. I do think that the Department of Homeland Security is probably involved because the person who led the three-man unit had worked for the Department of Homeland Security in New Orleans in post-Katrina. I mean, they have photographs of this guy at the police station. He's dressed in military clothes with a machine gun down in New Orleans.
Who is that?
And that was Michael Barber, Officer Michael Barber.
So he was down in New Orleans to help?
Yes, he was seconded, so to speak. He's a police officer, but he went down and worked with the Department of Homeland Security.
This is after the flooding?
Katrina.
This was
as, as like a volunteer, but it's not volunteer. He's getting paid, of course. He's probably getting paid extra. But they're very proud of this. This Michael Barber is the guy that went down there. And the photograph, they have a photograph of him, like I said, in a New Orleans neighborhood with dressed like he's in Iraq, you know, with all of the military gear and holding a machine gun in his hand.
Well, you know, the New Orleans incident, to most people, it was just another case of incompetence where the hurricane went over the city, and then the water level was just so high that the levees broke mysteriously in three different places. But in which case they would say that this officer was just down there to help in a normal manner. But you see, if you look closely at how those levees broke, there's a lot of reason to believe they were blown with explosives. And then that changes what this officer was sent for and why he was selected, you see. If he's part of this team, it was not to help the situation. It was to help control and suppress.
Exactly.
See, this is what people have to realize. If those levees were broken on purpose, then they weren't just selecting officers at random. They were selecting the ones that they could trust to keep the secret.
Yeah.
And for suppression, and that would explain why there was people, why they just couldn't for days on end figure out how to help any of the people down there from drowning.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's way beyond incompetence. Of course, like you said, there was no effort made, for example, to use the huge train station and the trains to take people out. There was no adequate preparation. And you know, the director of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, I've written about this. I wrote an article about how executive order made him the federal official responsible for the federal response to Katrina. And what's interesting is that after the Katrina fiasco, the complete disaster, he escaped getting blamed in the mainstream media. This Michael Chertoff, you know, the Israeli-American Homeland Security czar, is constantly protected by the media. And they chose to pick on his second or his you know, the guy that ran FEMA, for example, Mr. Brown, or other people took the blame. And eventually, President Bush took the blame. Whereas the person who's really responsible for the complete failure of Katrina was Michael Chertoff.
If they had, going back to your case, you know, if they destroyed the tapes on their camcorders, doesn't that right there almost make their case worthless? I mean, they're destroying evidence.
You would think so. You would think that this would, where it'll certainly lead to a motion. We'll file a motion for dismissal. But because it's destruction of evidence, which is potentially exculpatory in my case. It would, you know, if this evidence would be shown to the court, I would certainly not be charged with resisting arrest and aggravated assault.
Well, if you had destroyed that tape also, you have to consider if it was the other way around. If you had grabbed it from their car and burned it.
Right.
I mean, you'd be in trouble.
Of course. And that's interesting that you say that, because my wife saw this. And when I was being held down, it's interesting to note that one officer was kneeling on my temporal pressure point on the side of my head. There's a 200-pound guy with his knee, he was putting his full weight on the side of my head. And this is a pressure point. Pressure should only be applied if there's a scalp injury or something like that to this temporal pressure point for 30 seconds, no longer. He knelt on my head for every bit of 2 minutes. My face, of course, turned purple. My wife said it turned purple. My eyes were bulging out of my head. And she said I had a hard time breathing. And this is when they tasered me. Now, she saw this, and she was so shocked by the brutality of what was happening in her front yard, she said, I'm going to get the camera. This is crazy. And she went to the house to get the camera, and when she came out, the officer, Felgenhauer, told her, if you dare take any pictures, we'll arrest you. And that is also against the law on destruction of evidence, because it prevented my wife from getting evidence of the police assault. But I mean, this is, you know, I'm calling to you from Chicago, Illinois, outside Chicago. And Chicago has a history of this kind of brutality, but it also has a history of being a lawless city. And the courts, you know, I hope that the truth will come out in the court. That's why I've asked for a jury trial. But, you know, I'm not in the most, honest or lawful of jurisdictions.
Well, Chicago, they've always had this problem from what I've heard. I mean, everybody that's been through it. But what your treatment is like is what the Iraqi people must have felt when we went in there bombing them. What the American military, you know, the common soldier and the common policeman don't realize is that they are just being used.
Yes.
They are being used. They think of themselves as helping when they did this to you. But what they don't realize is they're the same sort of fools that you see the soldiers in Iraq are.
Yeah.
They're attacking people who have done nothing to them, who have no desire to hurt them. They're helping their own enemy.
Well, Eric, that's a very good point. You see, that the police in the United States have been working very closely with the Anti-Defamation League for a long time, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. And what the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith has been saying about me for a long time is that I'm an anti-Semitic conspiracy theorist. And this is based on, I guess, primarily, on what I've written about 9/11. And because I have dared to investigate the evidence of Israeli involvement in 9/11, I have been labeled as an anti-Semitic conspiracy theorist. Now, since November of 2001, they have been labeling me as this, with this. Now, why this is important, because they've done it several times. They come out with brochures. They come out with national press releases. Most recently, September 7th, 2006, in which they call me, I was number one. I was ahead of David Duke as being this anti-Semitic conspiracy theorist. Simply because of what I've written about 9/11. Simply because I look at the evidence, I talk about Israeli involvement, I look at it, and I investigate it. Now, this is dangerous because, you see, the Anti-Defamation League corresponds with police forces around the country. Particularly, they also, in this area where I'm calling you from, Schaumburg, Illinois, Hoffman Estates, Illinois, and they have communicated, and so if the police have been reading this material about me, if the Anti-Defamation League has been giving them the smear sheets about me, it means that this is where the malice comes from. You know, the like you said, the police then see me as being an anti-government. This is the one adjective they use on me a lot, that I'm anti-government. So then these police, in their simple-minded view of the world, say, this Christopher Bolin guy, he's anti-government, he's anti-Semitic, he's a right-wing extremist. Then they come to your house. We know who this guy is, you know, a couple pushes on the buttons on the computer and they find out who I am. And then they say, well, this guy, he's trouble. And that's why when they came to my house, they displayed so much malice.
Well, you know what, that's interesting. When you said they can punch your name in, what do they get? What does a policeman get when they put your name or my name into their database?
They get a lot.
Who is creating this database?
They get a great deal.
But
we're only privy to know, you know, what they have to turn over to us. But this is what I've been trying to find out. I spoke to the ADL the other day, and they're aware that they've been smearing me for years. And this would be the essence of a civil suit. I would really like to get to the bottom of who's behind this, because if the Anti-Defamation League has had any correspondence with the police about me, then they should be held responsible for smearing me. And partly responsible for the injuries and the punishment that I suffered.
Well, you know, another reason why the police are going to have a bad image of 9/11 conspiracy theories is if you ever listen to people like Alex Jones and almost all of them, they're constantly creating this hatred of police and telling us we're going to be a police state. Mm-hmm. You know, it's antagonizing them. All they have to do is listen to a little bit of Alex Jones and hear him ranting about how the police are disgusting, and it's just going to turn them off. You see, what all of these people are trying to do is create anger towards the police. They don't want us to go to them and educate them. They don't want us to talk to them.
Right.
They're trying to create this anger and fear so that the police automatically hate us. They think, oh, it's those conspiracy theories. Those people hate us. They want to throw rocks at us. They want to kill us. You see what I mean?
It's going both ways, because on the other hand, the police are becoming paranoid. A lot of people use the word paranoid because they are getting all this information from Homeland Security and from the ADL, in which average Americans are now becoming enemies of the state, so to speak.
Well, that's right. I think we need to really be looking at the police and ask them, where is their data coming from? We need to find that out. Because if they punch our names in and there's anything bad about us, we ought to know who wrote it. Who put it there?
This is the center of the whole thing. I called up to this local police department here in Schaumburg yesterday to ask them, and I finally got through to the guy who's supposed to tell me, and he doesn't want to answer the question. He said that unless I can provide on letterhead the name of the newspaper I'm writing for, in this case, he's not going to talk. And he's basically not going to give anything unless I come up with a FOI.
But information about ourselves, see, this is ridiculous. Information about you, You want to know what they are saying about you. I mean, I can understand them not giving information about someone else to you when they don't know who you are, but you ought to be able to know what they're saying about you. It's like knowing your own credit rating.
Of course, you know, and it gets also, for example, this is going on in not just 9/11 investigators. For example, there's this young man who was killed out in Delaware, Wilmington, Delaware. Derek Hale, I think his name was. And he was in a motorcycle gang. He'd been over in Iraq on two tours of duty, came back and joined a motorcycle gang. And, for example, he did have permission to carry a concealed weapon in Virginia. But the police did a quick attack on him when he was sitting out on somebody's porch in Wilmington, Delaware, and they tasered him, I think, three times, and then when he, then they shot him. They just shot him basically in cold blood with a .40 caliber gun. Now, the thing is that he was targeted because he belonged to a motorcycle gang. He belonged to a gang called the Pagans. Now, this is the same sort of thing, is that if the ADL, which it is warning police about the motorcycle gangs, the right-wing people, the left-wing people, you see, what they're becoming is they are becoming the political police, the thought police. They're becoming the new NKVD.
Well, what they're doing is taking over our police department.
Precisely.
And then what about Homeland Security? Because you look at who...
That's a good... I'm glad you brought that up. Homeland Security is also... Eric, Homeland Security corresponds with all the police departments across the country. And I'm holding in my hand here the Homeland Security Advisory Council's report on the future of terrorism, January 2007. And in there... ShareTalk recommends, about 16 pages long, it's available online, he talks about how this has to be fought at the local level, and that the Homeland Security needs to work with state, local, and federal responders. You see, they have to break down the wall separating these three groups and go to the local authorities. And that means that Homeland Security is just going to increase its role among local police in this country. And that's where it becomes a national police force. And that's very concerning. And what's interesting about this is that, like the secretary, they're talking about ShareTalk, should undertake, in conjunction with the director of national intelligence, a comprehensive national intelligence estimate to address threats to the homeland, both foreign and domestic. And see, this document goes on and on about how the American people are now suspect of being threats to Homeland Security. He goes on to say the secretary should work directly with state, local, private sector, and community leaders to educate them on the threat of radicalization, the necessity of taking preventative action at the local level to facilitate the sharing of other nations' and communities' best practices.
Now, what is this? This report is going to who? To
this is a Department of Homeland Security report produced by the Homeland Security Advisory Council.
And it's for the Homeland Security people.
It's for the United States. It's for the American people. It's a bunch of hooey. But what's interesting, if you look at the back, Eric, in the back, you see who the task force members are. And of course, at the top of the list is Lee Hamilton, the Honorable Lee Hamilton, who is. As I've written about, he's a Zionist lackey. He has the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and he is funded by people like the Simon family of Indiana. But there's much more interesting. In the task force members, besides Lee Hamilton, there's people like Elliot Brody, the billionaire from Los Angeles, James Schlesinger, the chairman of the MITRE Corporation, which I've written about, and their role in 9/11, the president and CEO of MITRE Tech, which is a baby company of MITRE, and others. But then it goes on, and who are these other nations that they're using in their for subject matter experts? This is where it gets really interesting. You know, this is where they have two Israeli brigadier generals. And they're the only military people in the whole thing. One is Major General Israel Ziv, and another one is Brigadier General Yosef Kupferwasser. And these are Israeli intelligence people at the highest level. These are the head people of Israel's military intelligence.
Are they still in Israel, or are they in America now?
No, they're in America. It's like one of them is Josef Kupferwasser. He is the Bronfman Visiting Fellow at the Chaim Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. And, you know, he used to be the head of military intelligence and the IDF Central Command. But now he's in a think tank. And you know, the Chaim Saban think tank was created after 9/11. In May of 2002, Chaim Saban, this Israeli guy who has invented the Power Rangers, some of these kids' TV shows, he made billions of dollars with this cartoon stuff and you know, taking over networks and whatnot. And then he gave $3 million to the Brookings Institute to create the Saban Center for Middle East Policy, I think it's called. And what's interesting about that is that he put Martin Indyk, the South African Jew who became an American in one day, in charge. And this is what happens, is these Israelis and Mossad, what they do is they create think tanks, which then are grafted onto well-known American think tanks like the Brookings Institution, and in that way, they're able to influence policymakers and military people in the United States.
So our Homeland Security is becoming infiltrated with Israelis.
This was to be expected, Eric. When we saw that Michael Sheretov, the Israeli national, he's an American Israeli, when he became the head of Homeland Security, then we begin to see that contracts and connections to the state of Israel were only increased. And here we see, you know, 5 years later, what we get. You know, and the other fella that's on this, Josef Kupferwasser is the first one. And I mean, this guy had a, you know, listen to, this is what his curriculum vitae says about him. He said that he was director of military intelligence for 5 years until June 2006. So from June 2001 to June 2006, he was the head of the research department of Israeli Defense Forces, Directorate of Military Intelligence at the time of 9/11. And in this capacity, he was responsible for preparing Israel's national intelligence assessment. And what he did is that during his military service, he's been involved in shaping the way that Israel has understood regional development and sharing those understandings with U.S. officials. Now that, in one sentence, tells you what's wrong with our system, is that when American military and American policymakers, who are rather naive of the Middle East, they rely on Israeli military people to explain to them what's going on in Iran, what's going on in Iraq, what's going on in Lebanon. And that's why our politicians and military people are so woefully ill-prepared to deal with the Middle East.
So we have these think tanks full of Israelis. We've got the news reporters like Wolf Blitzer telling us what to think about Arabs.
Right.
We've got the police department getting trained by them.
Right.
And what about this Brody character?
Elliot Brody, he's a billionaire down in Los Angeles. And he's one of the guys that wanted to take over the Chicago Tribune. But he has given... He's very close to the Israeli military, very close to the state of Israel. He gives them a great deal of money, and he's very tight with people like Benjamin Netanyahu and Ehud Olmert, Ariel Sharon, and he keeps a low profile. But he has this, capital groups in which he raises a lot of money and gives a lot of money to the state of Israel, He's considered Israel's mystery benefactor. He's a very, very big contributor to the Israeli military and very closely tied to the state of Israel. Now, that's what I'm saying is that, you see, these are the kind of what they call private sector people who are involved in this Department of Homeland Security, advisory council.
He's in it too, then.
So when you look at it and you sift it out, you'll find that every single one of those people is a Zionist.
They're all supporters of Israel.
Going to support and fight, you know, militant Zionism in the Middle East.
Now, he wanted to get over, buy the Tribune. Who's that? But I thought there was somebody else buying the Tribune.
Well, currently there's the Mr. Zell, and Sam Zell has taken over. And Sam Zell is a Chicago millionaire who his father came from Poland, and he was born here, you know, in 1941, I think it was. The family's name was originally Zielonka, means, I think, green in Polish. And this family left Poland in 1939, and according to the story, they took a train to Siberia, took a boat to Japan, and took a boat from Japan to Seattle, and came in through Seattle. But now, Sam Zell has made a lot of money in Chicago in real estate, and he sold his company pretty recently. He sold it to Blackstone. He sold it to Blackstone, and he got a heck of a lot of money, you know, billions of dollars. I think it was like $32 billion or something like that. And with that money, the profit that he made from the sale of his office realty company, he is buying the Chicago Tribune. And people are scratching their heads and saying, why is he buying print media? Although Chicago Tribune, you know, Tribune Corporation owns Chicago Cubs, and it owns a bunch of TV stations, and it owns, you know, like 18 newspapers across the country. So people are scratching their heads and saying, why is he buying that? But people don't understand how the media, ownership of the media, is so important to the Zionists. It's so important to the Mossad, because, just to give you an example, right now we have the kidnapping of this journalist. He's been kidnapped for about 3.5 weeks in the Gaza Strip. He's missing. There's been nobody. His name was Johnson. Is Adam or Alan Johnson? BBC journalist, very very good guy. Speaks with a monotone. But for 3 years he's been living in the Gaza Strip, reporting on what goes on in the Gaza Strip. He's been what the Palestinians call their bridge to freedom. He is the man who has presented to the world what really happens in Gaza, which is, you know, called the world's largest outdoor prison. It's used by prison. The Israelis control what goes in and what goes out of Gaza. Now, what the media talks about is that they assume that this man, Alan Johnston, was kidnapped by Palestinians. That's the assumption. And nowhere do they even breathe a word about the possibility that perhaps this man was kidnapped by Israelis. But if you look at the history, you'll see that over the last 30, 40 years, 20, even the last 10 years, most of the kidnappings that occurred in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank were done by Israelis.
Well, why would Arabs want to kidnap a BBC newsman anyway?
Exactly. And if he had been kidnapped by Palestinians, then the Palestinians would have made their ransom requests known right away. They would have said, we want jobs, we want money, we want representation, we want something, the usual.
Or they would have done, if he had been like Daniel Pearl, whoever the guy was, they'd behead him on the grounds that he's actually a Zionist spy. But
yeah, but the thing is that the Palestinians are very kind people, and they're very civilized people, and they do not usually kidnap people and hold them for a long time and do anything to them. Now, what's interesting, though, is that the assumption is that only Palestinians could have done this. Yet, you have to understand that the Gaza Strip, everything that goes into the Gaza Strip, everything that comes out of the Gaza Strip, has to go through Israeli control.
Well, it's been sealed for months now, hasn't it?
Years. And the Israelis have cameras and sensors and satellite equipment. They see what goes on in the Gaza Strip. Everything. They know what goes on. And furthermore, the two biggest Palestinian factions, the Hamas and the Fatah, these two big political factions that are fighting each other sometimes, they have no knowledge of this man. There's nobody's claiming responsibility. So that makes no sense at all. How could four armed gunmen kidnap this guy in the middle of Gaza? And everything is known in Gaza by word of mouth. There's a network there. Nobody knows anything about this. I suspect, I mean, I just say one has to consider the possibility that the Israelis have kidnapped this man in order to smear the kidnapping eventually onto the Palestinians. Because, see, there's a lot of progress that's being made now with the Iranian situation. The Iranians are putting forth a good foot. You know, the Speaker of the House, Pelosi, went to Syria, and Syria is looking better, and the Israelis don't like that. So they're trying to do whatever they can to smear the Palestinians. And that has to be understood, you know, that one of the main weapons of Israel is deception, and the tactic is false flag terrorism, or in this case, false flag kidnapping. Well, I wanted to say one thing about that. There was another guy that's on that Homeland Security task force, one of the experts. His name is Israel Ziv, Ziv, and this man is actually a terrorist. In November 2001, he planted a bomb in the Gaza Strip in Khan Yunis. He planted an IED, a roadside bomb, a large bomb. And a couple, five kids were walking on their way to school, and one of the kids kicked a rock into it, and this booby trap bomb exploded and killed these five kids. And the Jerusalem Post wrote an article about it, they talked about it, and they said that it was, Israel Ziv, Brigadier General Israel Ziv, was at that time the operation commander in the Gaza Strip. And it had been his decision to plant this IED, this bomb, in the first place. And his men had planted it just the night before.
This is what the Israeli...
this is what we're talking about. We're talking about Iraq, all these IEDs that are placed on the road, on the side of the road, under the road. And the Israelis have been doing this for years.
The Israeli newspaper admitted that he did it?
Of course. Oh. Jerusalem Post. Jerusalem Post. It happened November 25th, 2001. It was a booby trap. It was what we would call today an IED. And it was meant to be deployed, who knows, but it was probably meant to blow up when the proper Palestinian car went by.
But the kids end up...
And the kids... And they faulted him for not considering that, in the crowd of Gaza Strip that some kid might kick off this device inadvertently. But Eric, you see, this gets back to the whole thing we've been talking about for years now, about these planted roadside bombs, like what happened to Mr. Hariri, for example, the Lebanese prime minister. As I've been saying for years, he either was killed by a bomb that was dropped from an airplane that detonated in the street, or there was a pre-planted IED in the street, and his car was carried the sensor that detonated that bomb. But anyway, slice it. Whatever destroyed his convoy and killed Rafik Hariri blew up in the street,
Oh, yeah, the crater is enormous.
7 meters below, right. But see, this is the thing, Eric, is that here we have, this is from 2001, these Israeli military has been planting IEDs in Gaza for years.
Well, right, and they're fooling the soldiers into thinking they're coming from Arabs.
That's right.
But see, this is the same...
Now they're saying they're coming from Iraq. I don't know if you saw it today. An IED went off in Basra, in the south of Iraq, and it killed, I think, four British soldiers. And what is the response of Tony Blair? Blame the Iranians.
Well, they've been trying to say the Iranians have been providing parts for these bombs for quite a while now, but
right,
you see, this is what the police have to realize. The military is being fooled into thinking the Arabs are doing this to them. The police are being fooled into thinking people like you are their enemy.
Right.
And if you look at what you're saying, is the people like Broidy and Wasserman, these people, these Israelis and Israeli supporters and the Zionists are getting into Homeland Security, the FBI. They're training our police. They're buying up our media. They're taking over. And then that brings you to all of the people out there who are trying to blame the Bush family, the Rockefellers, the New World Order. See, there are even lawsuits going out, right? Well, they're trying to, get some lawsuits and get anger going towards, the Bush family and the Rockefellers and some of these other groups. This is what people have to realize now. If 9/11 gets exposed, which it looks like it's on the verge of it, it
right.
looks like they're really having trouble holding it back. If they can now, if the Israelis can now trick people into putting all of the blame on the Bush family, the Rothschilds,
right.
The CFR, a few other people they don't like, think about what this means. They will get rid of all of their competition, they will be able to take total control of everything.
Right.
They could take over the banks from the Rothschilds. They don't need the Rothschilds. They can run banks themselves. They don't need the CFR. They don't need the Rockefellers. And so if people don't watch out, what could happen here is they do let 9/11 get exposed, and then they use their thousands and thousands of people, like Alex Jones and Jeff Rentz and Henry Macau, Webster Tarpley, all of those people will be like a gigantic chorus pushing the blame towards Bush and the Rockefellers. Mm-hmm. And then that leaves, like you were just saying, Broidy, Sam Zell, the Wasserman, Israel.
That's why they need to control the media, because if they can control the media, then they will control completely the discourse. Like I said, I tried to post on the BBC talking point a little 300-word, 200-word thing about why doesn't the media even consider the possibility that this journalist has been kidnapped by Israelis, by Mossad or something. And they wouldn't, you know, it's moderated, so they wouldn't let my comment even be posted, although I made it very, very, you know, level and non-biased. I just raised the question. Because in the Gaza Strip, in the Palestine, in the territories, you have two parties at play. You have the Palestinians and their factions, and you have the Israelis. Now, you know, it seems very unfair if a crime has been committed in a place and there are two players involved, that you only consider one as being suspect, and the other, just by virtue of their identity, in this case being Israeli, doesn't even get raised, it could be Israeli. It's just like 9/11. Their control of the media prevented anybody from knowing that you know, bombs and explosions had occurred in the World Trade Center prior to them falling.
Well, right, yeah, and right now what they're trying to do is get control of what we call the alternative media.
Yeah.
You see, it's not just the media, but they're on the alternative media. They're putting websites up everywhere, running the radio stations.
Yeah.
And if they get control of the alternative media, you'll see every single one of them has this in common. And it's getting to the point where it ought to be obvious now, because they won't even mention you or me by name any longer.
Right.
That's how bad it's gotten. They're afraid to even give us bad publicity.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know that that's the way they've handled me for a long time. And you know, it's hard for just you and I and McDarrow and the few people that do investigate 9/11, you know, without any blinders. You know, it's hard for us. We don't have the financial support. We don't have the equipment. We don't have the networks. These people have networks, and that's the key thing, is that, like, you know, they will determine what is the kosher message regarding 9/11. And so they will have a limited hangout where they'll let certain material out, enough material to entice the skeptics, but only give them so much material. And, for example, raising any idea that Israel or Israeli intelligence or Israeli military was involved is taboo.
That's right. And, well, you see, the other thing they're also doing, I don't think, this is another one that most people haven't looked into, this voting fraud business. You know, you'll hear Bush stole the election. That's all you ever hear about. Bush stole it. It's always Bush. They never tell you there's cheating on both sides. And then who are the people who are trying to save us from the Bush family? You know, it's the same thing you'll see with 9/11. There's this group out there like Black Box Voting and some others saying that they're going to save us from this Bush family who cheats. And who are they? They're Zionists.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's going to happen is they will then get control of the voting also. So they'll have the media, Homeland Security. They'll be training our police, telling our military what to do. It's total control. And if they can get rid of the few people that they don't really like that much anyway, like the Bush family and maybe the Rockefellers,
mm-hmm.
they just get more control. It's growing. It was like Israel was boasting after our last elections that they now have more senators, more congressmen than ever before, more Jewish congressmen than before. They were boasting about it in their own newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
And so if people don't watch out with this voting fraud business too, what's going to happen is this group, like Black Box Voting, will get control to save us from Bush, and in reality all we're doing is letting a group of Zionists get total control of our voting. And we're going to be in worse trouble.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Eric, the thing about the control of the voting machines is not new. You know, when here in Chicago they use Sequoia voting machines, And when during the last election, the people that ran the voting machines were all Venezuelan people. They didn't even speak English. And they were the ones who were counting the votes in the county clerk's office in downtown Chicago. And yet, when I tried to find out Sequoia voting machines, I mean, come on, they count the votes for something like 40 million Americans. But nobody knows who owns the company, because it's a shell company in which a couple Jewish guys, I think, from Venezuela, Sephardic Jews, they are nominally the owners of the company, but the company then has the owner in Curaçao, and the parent company is in Holland, but these are all like shells. So we have no idea who writes the software or who controls the voting machines, who counts the votes in Chicago, and for 40 million other Americans. That's how bad the situation is. People who think that they can rectify the situation by voting in this country when they're not allowed to see the votes being counted are fooling themselves.
Well, plus, you have to ask yourself, even if the votes were counted, what good does it do when the only candidates that we get are the ones that they've selected for us?
Well, the thing is if we had open and transparent elections, and if we could see the votes being counted as they do in France, for example, that's a fundamental thing. Without that, you don't have democratic elections. Then the question is, like you're raising, how do you get third-party candidates in there when the Democrats and Republicans have it all locked up? And in this case, you know, as your listeners probably know, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are both Zionist-controlled parties. You know, the Democratic Party today, people who think the Democratic Party is going to be anything better for us should realize that the person who's controlling the caucus and making decisions of what the Democratic Party does is Rahm Emanuel, whose father was in the Irgun, you know, the Israeli Irgun, the Zionist terrorist. So, I mean, that's the alternative to the Bush family.
Well, I know. The Simon family are Democratic supporters also.
Right.
And then what about this Alberto Gonzalez you wrote about? See, what it looks to me like is this, again, they're not trying to save us from Alberto Gonzalez.
No.
This is, again, a group of Zionists that are just deciding they'd rather replace him with someone of their own that's even more Zionist.
Well, they figured, you know, that now Bush is weakened and he's a lame duck president, so they can get rid of his good friend Alberto Gonzalez, who's a big member of the Federalist Society. But they can get rid of Alberto Gonzalez. He's done his time. And you know, with 9/11, 9/11 coming out more and more, like you say, they need to have better control of the Attorney General's office. And so what I suspect is that Alberto Gonzalez will resign or will be pushed out, and he will be replaced with, if not Michael Chertoff, somebody of his ilk. There's Chuck Rosenberg, who is currently the chief of staff for Mr. Gonzalez, somebody like that. But somebody who's tied into 911, somebody who's involved in the non-investigation, somebody who's involved in the concealment of the evidence. Chuck Rosenberg is the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia. So he oversaw he controls the evidence from the Pentagon. For example, when you remember Sam Danner said that he walked through the Pentagon lawn picking up pieces of the aircraft and putting them into hefty bags. Well, I called up the FBI and I said, well, where are these hefty bags? Can we see what he actually picked up? If it's what he said he picked up. And they said, well, you have to ask Chuck Rosenberg because it's in Chuck Rosenberg's domain. It's in his office. He controls that evidence. So the evidence from the Pentagon crash site was controlled by Chuck Rosenberg. Well, he would seem to me to be a likely candidate to be the next Attorney General.
Chuck Rosenberg. So what it looks like is happening, or what they're trying to do then, is just get more control, and yet the people are being fooled into thinking they're replacing the bad Bush people.
Right. It's all about control, and the Zionist control in this country is increasing by leaps and by bounds. And you know, what we started out talking about is how you have the only two military people who are advising, you know, the Homeland Security Advisory Council on the future of terrorism are two Israeli brigadier generals. Where are the American generals? Where are the American admirals? You know, where is the American military? Which homeland are we talking about, Mr. Sheraton? Are we talking about the United States of America, or are we talking about Israel? I mean, that's a very valid question. But you see, when I raise questions like that, I'm labeled as an anti-Semite. And as you know, the 9/11 movement, what's left of it, I am pushed to the periphery. I'm not involved. I'm not allowed to speak in that. I mean, you know, my concerns, my questions are beyond the pale, so to speak. And the same thing with mainstream media. You know, when CNN came out here and wanted to interview me, they pretended that they wanted to look at the evidence. I printed out $12 worth of evidence for them to look at. You know, I had a lot of evidence for them to look at. They didn't want to see any evidence. They wanted to hear me blame the Jews for 9/11 so they could go ahead and call me an anti-Semite. But I of course wouldn't say anything stupid about that.
Right.
I mean, you know.
Well, it's just a trap. That's all they want to do.
Yeah.
But you see, you'll see this in this white supremacist movement too, where they rant and rave about Jews and all this as if it's to smear us all. And yet you look behind them and they seem to be Jews.
Yeah.
They seem to be the Zionists themselves.
Well, it's like you have on the top of the website, you have this excellent quote by Theodore Herzl, in which he basically says that the anti-Semites, or the anti-Semitic nations, are the best friends of Zion. Because without anti-Semitism, without the threat of anti-Semitism, Zionism would not have, so to speak, a reason for being. Or they wouldn't have an enemy, and so they're forced to create this enemy. I mean, I was just listening to a rabbi on public radio the other day talking about how there is no threat of anti-Semitism in the United States. It doesn't exist, and so they have to create this air. They have to create this fear. So that often, you know, when swastikas are painted in some graveyard or a synagogue is defaced, you often find out that the perpetrator is a Jewish fellow.
Well, the other thing that gives it away is they're trivial. You know, I mean, they're saying there's these horrible anti-Semites out there, and then what do? They paint a swastika on a gravestone? I mean, if there really were all these anti-Semites out there, they'd be taking rifles and shooting Larry Silverstein, Michael Chertoff, Rahm Emanuel. They wouldn't just be shooting them. They'd grab Emanuel and his family and drag them down the street behind their car.
Right.
They wouldn't just be spraying some Nazi symbols.
Exactly. And you see, one of the big targets in this whole thing, the Anti-Defamation League, their real target audience is American Jews. Because the American Jews, and especially the Zionist American Jews, have to be kept in line. You see, if American Jews and Zionist Jews in this country read very much of what you and I write, and if they were to, you know, read what I've written about 9/11, with an objective mind, they might very well be swayed and realize that the people they're supporting in Israel, Ehud Olmert and Ariel Sharon, are actually a great, great danger. I mean, the average American Jew doesn't think that Israel had anything to do with 9/11. But if they became convinced of that, if they saw the evidence, that would be very, very dangerous for the ADL and for Israel, because you know, they have to keep the American Jew in his ghetto mentality. They have to keep him
in the victim mentality too.
Victim mentality, ghetto mentality.
That they're being picked on. That they have to unite. Yeah, that they want them all to be united and work together to save themselves from these anti-Semites.
They want them to be kept fearful and suspicious of people like you and me, and keep sending the money and support to these Zionist organizations. But I mean, the average, you know, the average Jew or even Zionist Jew in this country doesn't think that Israel did 9/11. But the idea is lurking in their mind, you see. And if they were to see the evidence, then it would cause a real schism in Judaism. Because, you know, of course, if what I've been writing is correct, and if the facts and the data are correct, and if Israel was in fact involved in 9/11, imagine the consequences, the ramifications for American Jews.
Well, plus, then it leads you to what else have they been doing all these centuries, the past century?
Exactly.
And but now, one of the things that you might want to, now that you've got some more information on, you know, Homeland Security, one of the things where I'm constantly getting questions about is, how could this possibly be such a big group? Because I'm always being criticized when I say almost everybody in the truth movement's a liar, apart, you know, working with the Zionists, almost everybody in the alternative media, almost everybody in the anti-war groups, and people are like overwhelmed, like, how could it possibly be so big? And, you know, when you bring up what's going on, how Israel is basically like a supply center for these people, a training center. Isn't that what you're finding yourself?
Yeah, you're right. The training center is in Israel, and the headquarters are in Israel, but actually the supply ship is the United States, like I was talking about before. It's the wealth of the Jewish community and the wealth of the United States and the U.S. military, which is the supply ship for Zionists. And so that they've got the American military and American police, you know, like a bull with a ring in his nose. And they pull the military into Iraq or God forbid into Iran. I mean, people are talking now, you know, about the United States might even attack Iran tomorrow, like on Good Friday. They're saying that. Now, you have to ask yourself, why would they be saying that? Why would people like Booker Sharpley be promoting this idea? Well, one reason is because they wanna, you know, let this go as let it fly and see what the reaction is. You know, they have to let this idea out that the United States might attack Iran, might take out Iran's nuclear facilities or try to, might use unconventional weapons, just to see what the response will be. How do people react to this? You know, it's an outrageous idea. Iran is completely within its rights to be developing nuclear energy. All of the campaign against Iran is coming from one place. It's coming from Israel. And yet they have to try and see, will the Americans go along with this? And if they do, you know, if George Bush and the American military do something like this, this would be absolutely horrendous.
Well, yeah, and then plus, you've got like Herzliya with the universities over there. What do you see them as doing? What is their role in all this?
At Mossad University, that's the Interdisciplinary Center, the IDC, and that is in Herzliya, just north of Tel Aviv. And you know, we were talking about Sam Zell before. What these wealthy American Jews, these various Zionist American Jews, like Ronald Lauder and Mark Rich, Sam Zell, they have programs, they have colleges, they bankroll whole courses of study at the IDC. The IDC has one research field only. Their research field is their counterterrorism, and that's headed by Shabtai Shavit, you have his name. He's the former head of the Mossad. He headed the Mossad during the 60s. And this is the guy who is like running the school. Herzliya is the base of the Mossad. That's where they have their headquarters.
Well, are they training Mossad agents, or are they training people that end up in other nations also?
They're not training Mossad agents per se. They're training people who will work for the Mossad. Like Sam Zell, the guy who bought the Chicago Tribune, owns the Chicago Cubs, likes to ride a Harley motorcycle. He has the Sam Zell School of Entrepreneurial School program, something like that. And they handpick 20 students every year to learn learn entrepreneurial skills. Now, this is what I've been writing about for a long time, is that the Mossad then has venture capital firms, and they will find a product or a technology, usually somebody else's, and they will either buy it, take over, steal the idea, do something, and then they will create a company, a startup company in the United States, with this technology. And then, one way or another, this company, this technology, will wind up becoming part of a bigger technology, or of a bigger company. And then the Mossad and the Mossad technology get into that big company. For example, the way they got into Unisys, or many other companies. And this is what they do.
So they're not necessarily...
There's scores and scores and scores of software companies in the United States that are based in Herzliya, Israel. But you wouldn't know it by looking at the company. Only by, like, looking at the officers, the biographies of the officers of the company, will you see that these guys are all from Israeli, military.
So they're getting training, not necessarily as a Mossad agent, but as in Zionism and in... and they're getting their contacts with one another there and getting help in the business.
Yeah.
They're getting help. Is that, you think, where Mark Cuban is even in?
Oh, I don't know about Mark Cuban. He could be. But more, what this is designed for, Eric, is the training primarily of Israelis. They train Israelis. The language of education is probably primarily in Hebrew. And, you know, Mark Rich, for example, the guy that stole billions of dollars and who Clinton pardoned in his last day of office, Mark Rich, who's living in Switzerland, Mark Rich has a school there. This guy is considered a criminal in the United States, but in Israel, there's a whole college named after him where his methods of doing business are taught. Then there's Ronald Lauder. Ronald Lauder has a school of strategy and government. Ronald Lauder, he's the guy that privatized the World Trade Center, and which basically facilitated the 9/11 attacks and the profiting that was done. You know, prior to 9/11, the World Trade Center was owned, was a publicly owned property, was part of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. 5 weeks before, it was sold to Larry Silverstein. Larry Silverstein and Frank Lowy, the Israelis, became the owners of the property. That was only possible by Ronald Lauder's privatization.
Well, how did he do that with Pataki? What was his connection to...
Ronald Lauder was the head of the governor's privatization board for many years prior to 9/11. And he basically lobbied Governor Pataki to privatize the World Trade Center, to privatize Stewart Air Force Base, you know, that Stewart Airport, International Airport in Westchester, I think it is, and... He also hired Governor Pataki's wife to be his personal consultant, and she was getting paid more than the governor was. She was getting paid like six figures for about a decade prior to 9/11. So in this way, Pataki was owned by
the Lauder family, you mean?
Pataki was owned by who are we talking about?
Lauder.
Yeah, Ronald Lauder. Ronald Lauder. I get these guys all mixed up. Ronald Lauder owned the Pataki family. And I was getting ahead of myself because this is the same sort of thing we're talking about. I was thinking about Simon. Simon owns Lee Hamilton in the same way. You know, Lee Hamilton, the former congressman from Indiana, he was the co-chair of the 9/11 commission. And now he's heading this Homeland Security Advisory Board. Well, he's no longer even a congressman, but he is paid by the Simon family, the very wealthy Simon family of Indianapolis. These are the people that own many, many of the strip malls in the United States, and the shopping malls.
Right, so they own him.
And that's what happens is that when you see a person like Lee Hamilton being recycled all the time in these strategic positions, you have to ask, why? Why? What does Lee Hamilton have that nobody else has? Well, if you look at his connections, you find it out.
Well, the same with Obama. He's your senator of Chicago, of Illinois. What is he? And then who owns the Chicago police? And this is what the police should be telling us. Who are they? Who orders do they follow? Who owns them?
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have that much independence. It looks like the more you research into this. The Congress, all the congressmen, the newspapers, it's all pointing to Israel.
Yeah. Well, it's not just Israel. You know, Israel is like I said, like the headquarters or the base or the ghetto fortress, if you will. But it's there's a whole Zionist network, largely criminal, completely unethical, in the United States and in Europe. You know, these Rothschilds and these people like Simon family and the Ratner family. These people are the network outside of Israel that do its bidding.
So when 9/11 gets exposed, we got to make sure that people realize we've got to go after all of them. Don't just take the Bush family and a few Republicans.
Right, right. Well, you see, Eric, the thing is that now this is why the political season has started so early, because they can say they want to play up this Bush, you know, the Democrat-Republican divide. And clearly they want to try and put as much blame for 9/11 on Bush and Cheney.
Well, that's what Rosie O'Donnell is actually doing. If you listen to what she said on The View, she was pointing out how the Bush administration, almost everybody is indicted for something or under suspicion. Mm-hmm. It's always the Bush family. Focus on the Bush family.
Well, I mean, Eric, in that sense, with all due respect, she is right on a lot of things. You know, I've heard Rosie O'Donnell just a little bit about what she said about Building 7. She's speaking common sense, and she's bringing out information that has not been brought out in the mainstream media, at least not so clearly as she has done on that television.
Oh, right.
Show. But then you see this O'Reilly fellow is attacking her. But what she's doing is a good thing. And one thing you have to understand, one thing you have to remember is that the Bush family is very much tied to these Zionist Jews like Boris Berezovsky, for example. You know, and people like that. So the Bush family is complicit. People like Neil Bush and George Bush, they're complicit. They have been working with the Zionist Jews. I mean, George Bush, you know, for the whole time he's been in office, has never addressed the Palestinian issue. He's never talked to the Palestinians. He's never sat down and talked to the Syrians. He's never talked. So he has done their bidding.
Oh, yeah.
And now they're going to hang him out to dry.
Oh, yeah, that's true. But the trouble is that when Rosie talks, you see, she's even, apparently, Alex Jones is boasting that he's talking to her. See, they have, these people, like Charlie Sheen, they'll all talk with each other and help each other. Not any of us. Mm-hmm. You see, and this is what people have to watch out for, is that they will start exposing 9/11 and then control it. You know, it's like a flood. It's like a dam breaking, and now they're all down there with their sandbags trying to push it away from them and let the flood go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and that's what people have to watch out for right now, is what I see.
Right. Well, that's why they have to control the media as well, Eric, because they have to interpret the history of 9/11. That's what they're doing now. That's called interpretation of history. And the Zionists and their supporters want to control how people interpret the events of 9/11. And, you know, you and me, our version of events is still beyond the pale of light discussion in the controlled media.
Well, the alternative media,
the internet, that people can read what we write, and they can critically examine what I've written and the facts that I presented, and say, and look at your book, and they say, well, are these guys right or are they wrong? And I've never found anybody that says, Mr. Bowling, you are wrong about this, and proven it.
Right.
Because
well,
I mean, what I have written, I've written very carefully, and you know, some people try to attack me on the Sam Danner thing. You and I both know Sam Danner. And but I mean, when Sam Danner said that he was here or there or saw this at the Pentagon, I presented that as his testimony.
Right. Well, we can't verify any witness. I mean, for all we know,
just like what William Rodriguez said, and I thought it was very important. You know, William Rodriguez is a good guy. He suffered that 9/11, and he's talked a lot about 9/11. But when he told me he told us on the European tour that if Mrs. Clinton, if Hillary Clinton becomes president, he said he would be in a very good position.
Well, what was even more interesting is when he says they're grooming him for the governorship. See, they hold out little carrots on sticks for people. This is what I think they do to a lot of people. They say, you know, if you go along with us, you're going to be a Hollywood star, or you're going to be rich, or you could be get into politics. They don't necessarily give you the carrot, but it's always dangling in front of you. And if you don't wise up and realize you're being used, you know, you're just helping them.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, he told me, he's a very honest guy. Willie's a very honest guy, and he told me when we were in Venezuela, he said, you know, he got really upset that I was, you know, he and Jimmy Walter, they don't like me talking about Israel, Israeli involvement and this kind of thing, you know, about the dancing Israelis or the Odi going through messages. They didn't like that. And he told me, he said, you know, I can't talk about Israeli involvement in 9/11, he said. And I said, why not? He said it'll offend the Jewish relatives. And I said, wait, Willie, what about the American relatives? What about the American victims? You know, you're saying that it's okay to blame Bush and Cheney and the U.S. government, the U.S. military.
Well, the problem is that there's no support for anybody who comes out and says the kind of stuff we're saying, though. Me, you, Daryl, I mean, we're attacked constantly for this.
Well, there's not much support, but there is some support, and the support...
Well, there's not enough. Yeah. See, there's not enough to overpower. For most people don't have the whatever you want to call it, emotional strength to come out and do this. You see, and we're up against thousands and thousands of people who will attack for being you're anti-Semitic or you're un-American or.
Well, you see, Eric, they play the Holocaust card all the time too, and so that they label you and me and others. They'll label us being anti-Semitic, and then you know by association lump us in with Adolf Hitler, for example. That's what they're doing with Iran. I mean, just the U.S. supervisor, this brigadier general of the Israeli military. People like him are saying that Iran today is the threat that, for example, Germany was in the 1930s under Hitler. And that's what they're telling the U.S. military. That's what they're telling U.S. policymakers. And in this way, they're preparing to create the Third World War. I mean, the Third World War is already cooking. And they just want to keep adding fuel. And in that way, they're able to silence people like you and me. Because, you know, if they call us anti-Semitic, the American people have been so, mind-washed by this whole propaganda about the Holocaust that they're not able to think clearly anymore.
Right. Well, we better call this an interview. It's getting over an hour. So we'll have you on again. Maybe Daryl will be feeling better next time.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure, Eric. And I'll do some more writing about this Homeland Security thing and show these connections to the state of Israel, because this is really alarming when the Department of Homeland Security is being controlled and led by military people in the state of Israel.
And the police, too. When they're using our police force to do their dirty work, I mean, that's pretty sad.
Yeah. Well, the American people have to wake up, and, the threshold of pain is getting, it's getting worse and worse every day. And as we're talking now, we don't even know what's going to happen in the coming days and weeks, vis-a-vis Iran. Really, it's very urgent. The things we're talking about are very urgent, and I just wish that we reached more people and people would wake up to this reality.
All right, well, we'll talk to you later, Christopher.
Very good, Eric. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.